This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Willa of the Wood by Robert Beattie. Read for you by Emily Rankin. The Great Smoky Mountains, 1900. As Willa overheard the two dayfolk men talking about whether the earth was flat or round, she shook her head. They were both wrong. The world was neither flat nor round. It was mountains. Chapter 1. Willa crept through the darkened forest, following the faint scent of chimney smoke on the midnight air. The silver strands of the clouds passing in front of the moon cloaked her movements in shadow, and she made little sound stepping across the cold, wet leaves she felt beneath her bare feet. All during the night, she'd been moving down the slope of the mountain into the small valley where the homesteaders lived. When she came to the rocky edge of the river, she knew she was getting close to what she'd come for. She didn't know the river's mood here, so she avoided the dark and dangerous currents by climbing up through the gnarled limbs of the craggy old trees and asking for their help. As the branches reached out over the water to hold her, they rustled in the wind, talking to one another, as if concerned about where she was going. Her tunic of woven green cane flexed with the movements of her body as she climbed, the branches of the trees holding her gently, intertwining wrist and arm, ankle and leg, then letting go in turn, helping her across with the care that they would give a sapling granddaughter. She made her way hand over hand above the misty breath of the tumbling river, then slithered down a trunk on the other side.
"Thank you,"
she whispered to the trees, touching one spark with the palm of her hand as she left them behind her. Passing a tranquil pool of starlit water among the stones at the river's edge, she glimpsed her reflection. A 12-year-old will-o'-wisp of a forest girl, with long dark hair, a rounded face with streaked and spotted skin, and emerald green eyes. Unlike most of her clan, who coveted the glittering treasures of their enemies and even wore their deadened clothes, Willa wore no fabric or jewelry of any kind that might flash in the gloom. Wherever she went in the forest, her skin and hair and eyes took on the color and appearance of the green leaves around her. If she paused near the trunk of a tree, she turned so brown and barken that she became nearly invisible. And now, as she looked into the water, she saw her face for just a moment before it took on the color of the water and the nighttime sky above her, and she disappeared, her dark blue cheeks dotted with glistening stars. Continuing toward what she'd come for, Willa slunk low and quiet through the mountain laurel, up the gentle riverine slope, her heart beating slow and steady as she approached the homesteader's lair. She came from a clan of forest people that the Cherokee called the Old Ones and told stories about around their campfires at night. The white-skinned homesteaders referred to her kind as night thieves, or sometimes night spirits, even though she was as flesh and blood as a deer, a fox, or any other creature of the forest. But she seldom heard the true name of her people. In the old language, which she only spoke with her grandmother now, her people were called the Farren. Willa stopped at the edge of the forest and blended her skin into the surrounding textures of green. Tendrils of leaves wrapped around her. She became all but invisible. The soft sounds of the night's insects and frogs surrounded her, but she stayed alert, wary of beady-eyed dogs, hidden watchmen, and other dangers. She gazed toward the lair of the homesteaders. They had built it with the cut-up carcasses of murdered trees nailed one to the other in long slabs. The bodies of the dead trees made flat walls with square corners, unlike anything else in the forest.
"Just get what you came for, Willa," she told herself.
The lair had a high, slanted rooftop, a large railed porch that came around the front, and a chimney made of jagged rock the homesteaders had broken from the bones of the river. She saw no oil lamps or candlelight in the windows, but she knew from the thin line of gray smoke drifting from the chimney that the homesteaders, whom she sometimes called the day folk, because they retreated into their lairs when the sun went down, were probably sleeping inside in their long, flat, pillowed beds. She knew from experience that the homesteaders in this area locked the doors of their lairs at night, so she had to be clever. Through an open window? Down the chimney? She studied the lair for a long time, looking for a way in. And then she saw it. In the lower part of the front door, the owner of the lair had fashioned a smaller door for his white-fanged companion to come and go. And that was his mistake. Her heart began to pound, for her body knew the time had come, and the leaves withdrew from around her. She emerged from the cover of the forest and quickly darted across the open grassy area that surrounded the lair. She hated open areas. Her legs felt strange and uneven as she ran across the unnaturally flat ground. She dashed up the steps to the wooden porch. Then she slipped down onto her hands and knees, pushed through the little door, and crawled into the darkened lair to begin the night's take. Chapter 2. Once inside the walls of the lair, Willa scurried out of the moonlight filtering in through the window. She hunkered down on the floor in the shadowed corner of the eating place, the small quills on the back of her neck rising up as her eyes scanned the darkness for danger.
"Where's the biting dog?" she wondered. "Are all the day folk upstairs in their beds?"
Holding her breath, she slithered across the floor and looked out into the main room of the lair for attackers. She waited, she watched, and she listened. If they caught her here, actually inside their lair, they would kill her. They had hacked the trees of the forest and hunted the animals. They had murdered her mother, her father, her twin sister, and so many others of the Dead Hollow lair.
The day folk did not think. They did not hesitate. Whether it was the wolves who howled to find their loved ones in the night, or the great trees who raised their limbs to the sun, the day folk killed whatever they did not understand. And they understood very little of the forest into which they had come.
As she pulled in a slow and steady, tightly controlled breath, she heard the sound of the small metal-wound machine ticking on the fireplace mantel, and the slow hiss and crackle of the dying embers that had led her here to the lair. The scent of something startlingly sweet reached her nose. She tried to ignore it, but her stomach growled. She turned to see a round, stone-like container sitting on a flat wooden surface above her. She knew she shouldn't let this distract her, but she'd been so hungry yesterday and all through the night. She quickly rose up, lifted the container's lid, and gobbled down several of the small, crumbly lumps inside like a ravenous raccoon. As her mouth watered with the sweet flavor, she couldn't help but smile, but she was careful not to leave any crumbs that the day folk might notice. She wanted to eat more of the lumps, but she stuffed half of what remained into her woven reed satchel and hurried on her way. As she snuck into the main room, she noticed a rectangle of tin with a mottled depiction of several of the dayfolk, as though they had looked into their reflection in the pool beside the river and never escaped. A clean-shaven man, a dark-haired woman, two little ones maybe 5 and 6 years old, and a tiny crawler in the woman's arms. But Willa didn't look at them for long, because she didn't like to think about their souls inside the metal.
"Get what you came for," she told herself again, and pressed on.
Glancing nervously at the stairway as she worked, she quickly searched the main room for valuables. She found a small wooden box filled with a moist, brown substance that she was pretty sure was chewing tobacco. She stuffed half of it into her satchel. It wasn't the kind of takings she was keen for, but she knew the Padawan, the leader of her clan, would be pleased by this special gift. She could see herself standing before his looming figure as she emptied her satchel in front of him, his eyes gleaming with approval. Feeling pleased with herself, she continued on. In a very small, tightly enclosed room filled with nothing but clothing hanging down from strange, shoulder-like shapes, she found a long, dark overcoat with a leather wallet and coins in the pockets, and she smiled. She took half the bills and half the coins. These were the takings the Padawan had trained her to find. The Padawan sent her and the other Yaters, the young hunter thieves of the clan, out each night, and he gave his love to the ones who returned with their satchels full of coins or anything else of value. She glanced at the stairway again, knowing that when danger came, it would come down those stairs. She'd already had a good take, and she knew that a wise Yater left when the leaving was good. But she wanted more. When she'd returned to Dead Hollow the night before, her satchel had been light, and the Padawan had struck her face so hard with the back of his hand that she'd fallen to the ground, astonished and ashamed to be wiping the blood from her mouth. Over the last few months, she'd thought that she had become his favorite, but now he had struck her, just as he did the other Yaters, and she still felt the fire of it on her cheek. Tonight she wanted more, more than she had ever taken before, to prove to the Padawan and the rest of the clan what she could do. Finally, she went over to the bottom of the stairs, cupped her hands behind her ears, and closed her eyes, listening to the rooms above. She heard a man snoring, and there were probably other dayfolk up there, too, a little clutch of them, sleeping away the night. "But where's the dog?" she wondered again. "The dog is death." She'd run into trouble with the fanged beasts before, with their loud barking and their vicious, biting, scratching attacks. "I can smell the wretched creature around here someplace," she thought. "I used its door to get in. But where is it? Why hasn't it come charging out at me with its snapping teeth?" Most of her fellow Yaters stole things from unattended wagons, midnight yards, and dark morning barns when there were no dayfolk around. Very few ever dared to sneak into the dayfolk lairs, and none would do it when the dayfolk were actually inside. The Yaters had been trained to go out together in small groups, and to never take such risks. But she put her foot on the first step and began to creep up the creaky wooden staircase, treading as lightly as she could on the strangely flat surfaces, so unlike anything she encountered in the forest. When she reached the top of the stairs, her legs trembled as she inched slowly through a narrow, cave-like tunnel toward the open doorway of the first room. In the forest, she could use her camouflage and her other powers, but her powers didn't work in the inner world of the dayfolk. Here she could be seen.
She could be captured.
She could be killed. Her palms were sweating as she slowly peeked into the sleeping man's room. She had noticed on her other takes that the Dayfolk seemed to sleep in twos. But this man was sleeping alone, on one side of the large bed, as if the one he slept with was gone. But there beside him was the biting dog she'd been looking for, a shaggy black-and-white fiend, lying fast asleep beside its master, its white fangs and sharp claws visible in the moonlight. The man's face was bristled with whiskers, and he was lying on top of the covers, his clothes torn and wrinkled, as if he had collapsed there in exhaustion. A chair and a small table and other dayfolk things had been knocked to the floor as if there had been some sort of struggle. There was a wound on the man's head, and a mat of dried blood on the dog's shoulder. Seeing the blood, Willa's heart pounded heavily in her chest, and she swallowed hard. Had they attacked one of the animals of the forest and been entangled in a battle? But then she frowned in confusion. If they had fought something in the forest, that wouldn't explain the knocked-over furniture in the room. And then she saw it. Lying in the bed next to the man and his dog, there was a long piece of metal with a wooden stock and what looked like two iron pipes side by side. "That's a killing stick," she thought. "Right there beside them." She drew in a ragged, unsteady breath and fought the urge to run. Chapter 3 Willa looked at the killing stick with dread. She'd never seen one this close. She didn't know how they worked, but she'd watched enough hunters in her woods to know their wicked power. She'd seen deer struck dead from a distance, hawks killed in midair. During the previous winter, she'd found a wounded wolf lying on the forest floor and bandaged her wounds with healing leaves so that she could get back to her starving pups. The man lay with his eyes closed in the bed. His hands moved restlessly beside his body, touching the killing stick and the exhausted dog as he muttered in his troubled sleep. Willa knew she should go, but she also knew that some of the most valuable things in the lair would be in this very room. Into the room she crept, nothing but a shift of darkness moving through the shadows. Slipping over to the dresser, she quickly snatched half of the necklaces and earrings she found in the jewelry box, liking the weight of her satchel more and more. The little ones in her clan who didn't steal, and steal well, didn't get fed. It was the way the Padawan had run the clan since before she was born. If you didn't return to the lair with your satchel full, you didn't get dinner. And if it happened two nights in a row, you'd get worse than that. The Padawan had told her many times that the Dayfolk were rich and didn't need their money or their belongings. And when she looked at everything the Dayfolk had, she thought it must be true. But she also thought maybe it was better to take only half of what she found and leave the rest behind, just in case the Dayfolk and their children were hungry too. She had stolen from many of the homesteads along this river. Stealing only half of what she found made her takings less noticeable. Move without a sound, steal without a trace. That was what she had taught herself. If the Dayfolk were truly rich, then they wouldn't notice a few things missing come morning. Of course, she could never tell the Padawan about her rule of halves. He'd thrash her until the stream that ran beneath their lair turned red. But she was very good at stealing, and he was usually well pleased with her take. She knew she was one of his favorites, and she was determined to keep it that way. her grandmother, her mamma, whom she loved with all her heart, had told her that there had once been a time when the Farron had lived in the forest, desiring nothing but what the forest could provide them. But when the homesteaders came cutting with their axes and building their candle-lit homes in the woods, the Farron began to change, their words, their wants, their ways. Sometimes, when Willa was way out in the forest alone, apart from the rest of the clan, she felt the power of the forest and its creatures deep inside her, and she knew that her mamma was telling her the truth. There had been a time before. The man jerked in his sleep, snorted loudly, and took a sudden gasping breath. Willa leapt back in surprise, her limbs flooded cold with fear. But then the man mumbled something in the darkness, as if he was fighting something in his dreams. The dog adjusted its position, and the two of them fell back to sleep. When Willa started breathing again, she shook her head in mocking disbelief. That dog was worthless. It couldn't smell a thing. She was right here next to them, and it didn't even know. Feeling more confident than ever, she searched the top of the dresser for more valuables. She noticed a closed black book with a long red tassel hanging down from the pages. The book had a short, single-word title that she could not read. Sitting on the book, there was a gold ring. She picked up the ring and held it up in the moonlight that shone through the window. It was one of the most beautiful dayfolk things she had ever seen. What is this gleaming thing for? She wondered. What is its magic? Noticing a glint of light out of the corner of her eye, she looked over toward the bed. The sleeping man wore an identical gold ring on the third finger of his left hand. She knew she should take the gold ring from the dresser and run as fast as she could. Take it and leave, she told herself. It had to be the most valuable thing in the lair, and it would definitely be the most valuable thing she'd ever brought back in her satchel. She could imagine the Padawan's snarling grin as she set the shining gold ring in his awaiting hands.
This is a good take, girl.
He'd rasp in pleasure, all the other yaders ducking and sniveling around him, their jealousy writhing through them like poison as they snapped and hissed at her. But as she held the golden ring in her hand, a sickening feeling crept through her. She tried to convince herself that taking one of the rings wasn't breaking her rule of halves, but there was something in her that felt strangely uncertain. Sometimes, two things weren't just two things. They were a pair, and a pair was a thing. Half wasn't always half, she thought. Sometimes half was whole. She didn't know what the rings were for or what they meant, but it seemed wrong to take one, to separate it from the other. Like tearing a wing from a swallowtail butterfly and telling herself it could still fly. Before she could change her mind, she reluctantly set the ring back on top of the book where she'd found it and crept out of the room of the snoring man and his dim-nosed, deaf dog. She moved quickly toward the next room, determined to stay focused. The next room was draped with dresses. Her heart quickened at the thought that she was going to see a dayfolk girl up close. The girl's scent hung in the air, but there was no little girl sleeping in the room's bed. The fact that it was the middle of the night and the girl was gone seemed very strange. But Willa went over to the girl's dresser and took a shiny bracelet, a silver hairpin, several velvet ribbons, a tiny porcelain doll, and a locket. As Willa darted down to the next room, It smelled immediately of boy. She knew it was a dayfolk boy, but it was boy all the same. On a breezy day, she could smell boys from across a meadow, whether they were dayfolk or night. But the boy's bed was empty as well, the covers twisted onto the floor. Willa's brows furrowed. Where did the boy go? And where is the little sister girl who should have been in the previous room? And why is the man sleeping with his killing stick on his bed? Get what you came for, she told herself, shaking her head and continuing on. They were the words she used whenever she became ensnared in the bewildering details of the dayfolk's lives. Get what you came for and go, Willa. She hurriedly searched the boy's room for valuables. The first thing she found looked like a large leather glove made for a giant hand. The boy's hand must be grotesquely deformed and misshapen, she thought. Beside the glove lay a white ball and a stout wooden walking stick of some sort. The boy's legs must be crooked as well. She felt a little sorry for the poor, crippled creature, but she stuffed half of his coin collection and half of his Cherokee arrowheads into her satchel and dashed down the hall toward the fourth and final room. Get what you came for. But then her ear twitched, and the quills on the back of her neck stood on end. The snoring had stopped. The man had awoken. She heard the muffled sound of movement, covers being pulled back. She felt the vibration as his feet hit the floor. Get on up, boy, the man whispered urgently to his dog. They're back. Willa exploded into motion. She sprinted down the length of the hallway, racing for the top of the stairs. The man charged out of his bedroom with his killing stick. Willa flashed by him, nothing but a dark streak. He must have been as startled by her as she was by him, because he lurched back in surprise. She dove headlong down the darkened stairway, her feet barely touching the steps. But the startled man raised his weapon and aimed blindly into the darkness. A flash lit the air on fire, and the sound of it shook the world. The blast struck her in the back. The force of it knocked her careening forward. She slammed into the wall at the turn in the stairway and tumbled down the rest of the stairs like a raccoon shot from a tree. The lead shot ripped through her tunic and riddled her shoulder blade and arm, white-hot lightning piercing through her body as she crashed onto the floor at the bottom of the stairway. The enraged man and his growling dog were charging down the stairway to finish her off. Get up, she told herself, trying to find her way through the pain. Get up, Willa! You've got to run! Chapter 4 Willa lay crumpled on the floor at the bottom of the stairs, her right leg bent badly beneath her left, her arm twisted under the weight of her body. Her head lay flat against the boards, blood dripping down into her eyes as she gazed out at the dead furniture and murdered walls of the shadowed lair. She could see through her eyes, and she could hear the wheeze of the air moving in and out of her lungs, but she couldn't get her arms and legs to move. The only thing she could feel was the pain of the blast radiating through her shaking body. She lay helpless, stunned, and bleeding on the floor. She felt the man's footsteps coming down the stairs behind her. His dog tore out in front of him, a blazing burst of growling teeth. The beast clamped onto her calf with its fangs, sending sharp bolts of new pain shooting through her limbs, jolting her alive. She spun around, screaming, and struck out with a quick, jerking motion. The dog pulled back, trying to drag her with its teeth, but she wrested herself free. The snarling beast lunged in for a second bite, but Willa darted away. The dog chased her, gnashing its teeth behind her as she scurried across the eating room floor. She dove through the dog door, scrambled across the porch, and ran, fleeing out into the night,
desperate to reach the safety of the forest. The man threw open the door and charged out, aiming his killing stick into the darkness. Another shot exploded the world, shattering the night with a flash of light and a deafening roar as Willa scrambled away.
"Get him, boy! Get him!"
the man shouted as the dog flew off the porch after her.
"I'm going to kill you this time!"
he screamed at her. She knew that she'd been moving so fast through the darkness of his lair that he hadn't truly seen her. But he was angry, far angrier than she expected from a race of beings who were supposedly so rich that they didn't need most of their belongings. "Get to the trees! Get to the trees!" she thought frantically as she stumbled across the grass toward the forest. But she felt dizzy and disoriented, filled with nothing but pain and panic. Her head throbbed. When that first blast hit her, it had slammed her against the wall and then tumbled her down the stairs. Now the blood was oozing from her head down into her eyes, blurring her vision. Running nearly blind, she ducked into the first cover she came to. She scrambled into a small, closed-in place, gasping for breath, and hoping the dog would pass her by. All she wanted to do was close her eyes against the pain and curl up into a little ball. But she knew if she withered here, she'd die. She wiped the blood from her eyes and tried to look around her. Had she crawled into a hollow log? Maybe she'd been lucky enough to find a fox den. But then she smelled something. And it wasn't fox. It was goat. Her heart sank. She'd made it only as far as the homesteader's barn. As she scuttled out of the pen, the startled goats ran bleating out into the yard, and the chickens flew up in a squawking explosion of feathers. "Get to the forest," her mind kept telling her, but she knew it was too late. She could hear the man and his dog charging toward the building. She scurried deeper into the shadows of the barn and hunkered down to hide. A debilitating fear gripped her chest.
"If they ever catch you alone in their world, they will kill you, Willa," the Padawan had told her. "They cut down trees and burn with fire. They killed your sister and your parents."
The barn door creaked slowly open. The flickering light of the lantern entered first, and then the gleaming double barrels of the killing stick. The man came in slowly and cautiously. The day folk were oddly blind at night. He held up his lantern, straining to see in the dim light, his weapon pointed in front of him. Willa lay crumpled, curled up on the floor in the corner, wounded and bleeding, panting with an exhaustion so all-consuming that she couldn't move. Like a fawn that had been shot through her heart and lay on the ground breathing her last breaths. Willa had the power of the forest animals within her, but none of her powers worked in this unnatural place. She could tell by the man's careful movement that he couldn't quite make out what type of man or beast he'd shot in the darkness and cornered in his barn. It wasn't until he raised his lantern and peered at her at close range that he got his first good look at her. She could just imagine what she must look like to him, lying in the dirt like a trapped animal in the corner of his barn, shaking with fear, her greenish arms and legs pulled up to her chest moving up and down with fast, ragged breaths, and the blood dripping down her face between her emerald eyes. When the man finally saw her, and she lifted her eyes and looked at him, his expression changed from grim determination to utter astonishment. The viciousness that had consumed him moments before disappeared as he tried to comprehend what he was seeing. She saw him realize, in the light of his lantern, that the thing he'd trapped in his barn wasn't a man or a beast.
"What?"
He began to ask in confusion,
"What are you?"
She could hear in the tremor of his voice the realization that he had shot some kind of strange little forest creature. Not just a creature, but a girl. She didn't know what he was expecting, what type of enemy he thought had invaded his lair in the dead of night. But it was not this. It was not her. Willa looked down the double barrels of the killing stick pointed at her. This man could shoot her again, right here and now, and end it all. All he had to do was pull the trigger. Or he could strangle her with his bare hands, or strike her in the head with a shovel. Without the powers of the forest, she could not defend herself from him. She was helpless. But as she looked into his face, she saw something that she did not think was possible in a Dayfolk man. Kindness.
I don't understand, he said in bewilderment. Where did you come from? Who are you?
I'm Willa, she thought, but she did not answer his question out loud. The Panoran had brought the English sounds into their clan long before she was born, and she knew the sounds well enough to understand him. But whether she was using the old language or the new, Willa spoke to trees, not the men who killed them. How could day ever comprehend night? How could darkness ever know light? How could she say her name to a man such as this?
Just hold on, he said gently, watching her with steady eyes as he knelt beside her trembling body.
He set the killing stick and the lantern down onto the dirt floor of the barn. All the anger and fear that had consumed him moments before seemed to have disappeared from him now. So wickedly fast these humans seemed to change their spirit.
I'm going to take a look at the wound, he said as he pulled a white cloth from his pocket and moved toward her as though he was going to try to stanch the bleeding.
But he was human. She knew she could not trust him. She stayed perfectly still. She didn't move in any way as his hand came closer and closer. Her heart pounded in her chest. The moment he touched her, she sprang to her feet. Startled, he pulled back in surprise. She darted past him. The dog snapped at her but missed. With her last burst of dying energy, she dashed through the doorway of the barn and out into the darkness. She ran across the grass. The moment she reached the edge of the forest, she blended into the night and disappeared. The last thing she had heard him say as he grabbed his lantern and his killing stick was,
"Come on, boy. We're going after her."
Chapter 5 Willa knew that the darkness of the forest would hinder the man and his dog for a few minutes, but not for long. The human would come trudging through the forest, lighting the way with his box of captured flame and carrying his killing metal, as all Dayfolk did. But what she was most worried about was the dog's speed through the underbrush and its powerful sense of smell, which she knew was akin to her own. She had foolishly scoffed at the dog when it had been fast asleep, but now that it had tasted her blood, it would be unstoppable. She had been hunted by dogs before. They were simple beasts, but relentless on a scent. She picked up a handful of dirt, raised it to her mouth, and filled it with her breath. Then she cast it wide behind her, dispersing the scent of the direction she'd taken. She stumbled deeper into the forest, pushing through the spasms of pain from the lead shot that had struck the back of her shoulder and arm. She crunched leaves and broke small sticks beneath her treading feet, making noise that she wouldn't normally make, but she had to move fast. She had to escape. Finally, she came to the reflecting pools at the rocky edge of the river. She didn't have the strength to climb up into the cradling arms of the trees and cross over the top as she had before. And she was far too weak to wade through the rapids. But she had to cross the water somehow to throw the dog off her trail. The dirt she'd cast behind her would confuse it for a little while, but when the dog came to the river, it would run up and down the shoreline with blind, sniffing persistence until it found her scent again. In the far distance behind her, she could hear the sound of the man's tromping feet coming in her direction. She spotted the faint line of a deer trail that ran along the bank of the river. She knew that deer never crossed or even waded into fast-moving water, so she followed the trail, hoping it would take her to what she needed. When she reached a shallow riffle running over the small, rounded stones of the riverbed, she knew it was her only chance. She immediately started to cross, but even here the river dragged at her angrily, the white water bunching up like mountains around her knees, pulling at her, trying to drag her in. She fought against it, tried to keep pushing through it. But she finally lost her balance and collapsed down into the river, beset with pain, and the cold power of the water took hold of her and swept her away. She kicked and she sputtered, gasping for air in the churning water, terrified that she was going to drown. But then the current pulled her quickly forward and slammed her against a rock. She grabbed hold. The raging water immediately wanted to tear her away, to pull her down into its darkest holes, but she gritted her teeth and held on to the cold, hard surface of the rock. She clung to it. "Climb it, Willa," she told herself. "Climb it." She reached up her hand, found a crevice with her fingers, and pulled, dragging herself slowly out of the river. The back of her shoulder throbbed. Her right arm and that whole side of her body felt numb, like all the blood had seeped out of it into the churning dark waters of the greedy river. She crouched down in between the large, jagged, broken boulders that crowded the river's edge and asked for their protection. The cracked, moss-covered rocks towered over her head, making caves between them where she could hide. She had always loved the feeling of climbing among rocks like these, and it gave her comfort to rest among them now, but she knew she couldn't stay here. The rush of the river was drowning out many sounds, but she knew that the man and his dog were still coming, still on her trail, and they would find her here. She had to keep going, but she was exhausted and bleeding. Her lair and her clan were miles and miles up through the mountains beyond her reach. She could find no help from there. But she could not let herself give up. She needed to find a way to escape. She had lived in the forest all her life, and she had taken pride in helping the animals who needed her care. But she realized that this time, she was the one who needed help, or she was going to die. She lifted her head, tilted her face toward the gleaming moon, and began to howl. It was a pitiful, soft little sound at first. She was weak and not used to making any noise, especially when enemies were on her trail. But soon she pulled the pain of her wounds into her throat, and she let out a long, plaintive howl. She howled in the way she had been taught, not by her mother who'd been killed years before, or even by her grandmother who'd raised her, but by a mother she'd befriended the winter before. As the sound of her howl went out into the night air, she could imagine it drawing in predators from miles around, sharp-clawed creatures ready to prey on the weak and wounded thing she had become. And she could imagine the tracking dog and killing man raising their heads toward the sound and knowing they were getting close. At first, all she could hear was the relentless, rushing voice of the river. But then she heard a faint sound in the distance. She stepped out from among the rocks toward the forest, cupped her hands behind her ears, and listened again. There, she thought, very far away. It was another howl. She She howled again. The returning howl sounded much closer now. Whatever it was moving fast, coming at a run. Her heart began to thump in her chest. Even though she was the one who had started the howl, she couldn't help her legs from shaking. There was a part of her that was telling her that she had made a mistake, that she should run now, scurry quickly away, or duck back down into the rocks and hide. She heard the beast pushing toward her through the undergrowth of the forest. She knew what she had done was dangerous, that it might get her killed. Very close now, a pair of silvery, moonlit eyes peered at her from the darkness of the forest. She took a long, deep breath, used her powers to consciously slow down her heart, and tried to stay calm. "You can't back out now," she told herself. "You must finish what you started." But then 30 more pairs of eyes appeared in the forest, all gazing at her. Not just one had come, but many. She looked toward the closest pair of eyes gazing at her from the darkness.
"Un donatra dunam far,"
she whispered in the old Faerun language. "I need your help, my friend." But at that moment, the light of the man's flame came flickering through the trees. Chapter 6. A large wolf emerged from the forest a few feet in front of her, her silver-gray eyes studying Willa intently. And then, behind the leader of the pack, she saw the others, the pale blue eyes of the younger wolves, and the gray and golden-brown eyes of the older wolves. These were the great warriors of the forest, the clawers and the biters, and on any other night they might have tracked and taken down a little creature like her. But Willa looked into the eyes of the leader of the pack, crouched down to the ground in front of her, and said the words to her again.
"Un donatra dunam far."
The leader of the pack stared at her. She was a beautiful animal, with a thick blackish-gray coat and the muscles of many hunts. She had a strong nose and mouth, and held her ears up high, alert for the coming danger, the man and his dog coming toward them through the forest. Wolves and the other animals of the forest didn't have names in the English language of the Dayfolk, but in the old language, Willa knew her name was Luthien. She looked so different from the winter before, when Willa had met her and helped her, when the wolf had lain on the forest floor, shot by a hunter and torn by his hounds. And now, by the flow of time, all had come around. Luthien lay down on her haunches so close at Willa's side that she could feel the warmth of the wolf's fur against her shoulder. Wincing in pain, but knowing that it was her only hope to live, Willa crawled onto the wolf's back. The Dayfolk man had seen her in his lair and wounded her. She didn't understand why he had tried to help her in the barn. What kind of trick or twist of hatred had compelled him to such an act? But she knew she could not trust a human. And she knew that now that he had seen her, he would not let her go. He and his snarling dog and his clanking box of captured light and his killing metal were coming, moments away now, thrashing through the forest, trampling leaf and breaking branch, to capture her and pull her back into their world. As Luthien rose to her feet, Willa wrapped her arms around the thick scruff of the wolf's neck. "The dog in the man's pack has the nose to track us," Willa said in the old language, knowing the wolf would know what to do. As the man and his dog came through the undergrowth of the forest, Luthien turned and looked at the other wolves of the pack. With a tilt of her head and a turn of her body, she gave the command. The other wolves turned and dashed in a dozen directions into the forest, yipping and yelping as they ran, as if inviting the coming enemy to pursue them. The moment they were gone, Luthien lunged into the darkness and leapt into running speed. Suddenly, Willow was flying through the forest, her hair whipping behind her. Her shoulder burned with pain, and the blood from the cut on her head was dripping onto Luthien's thick coat. But Willow felt the joy of it, too, clinging to the wolf's back, tearing through the forest faster than she ever had gone. The trunks of the trees rushed past her. Great jutting rocks flashed by. The leaves of the bushes were but puffs of air swishing against her face. She felt the driving beat of the wolf's heart against her own, the air surging into the wolf's lungs, and the heat pouring out of the wolf's open mouth as she ran, her teeth gleaming in the moonlight. Willa looked into the forest to their left and to their right to see two strong male wolves running with them, guarding their flanks. Craning her neck, she saw that two young wolf pups were following close behind. She couldn't see the other wolves of the pack anymore, but she knew they were out there, running through the forest in opposite directions. There was no way for even the keenest tracking dog to follow them all.
"The wolves teach us how to work together," her mamma had told her. "They hunt together, defend their territory together, play together, and raise their pups together. It's through their love for one another that they survive."
Willa knew she wasn't a wolf and never could be, but it was the kind of kinship that she had always longed for. Leaving the ravine of the river far behind them, Luthien climbed up through the rocky, forested ridges of the high ground, taking Willa up the slope of what the Faerun people called the Great Mountain. The Cherokee called it Kuwahi, but the Dayfolk called it Klingman's Dome on their maps, made from the ground-up flesh of trees. It seemed as if all the locations in her world had many names, old names and new, night names and day, as if the names, too, were fighting to possess these ancient places. It was seldom used anymore, but one of her favorite names for this place was the Smoky Mountain, for she had seen it say its name many times. In the waking dawn of each new morning, the white mist of the Smoky Mountain's breath floated near its rounded top and out across the world, flowing down into hidden coves and sweeping valleys, out to the other mountains and ridges, and down through the fog-shrouded trees and over the tumbling misty rivers, as if the Smoky Mountain itself breathed the life into the world each morning and took it back again each night. Dead Hollow, the hidden lair of her people, was way up on the north slope of the Great Mountain, a place so treacherously remote and so shadowed by thick trees and steep ridges that no Dayfolk had ever trodden there. But as she gazed around her through her blood-blurry eyes, she realized that wasn't the direction the wolves were going.
"Where are we going?"
she tried to ask in the old language, but her voice was too thin and raspy to be heard. As she clung to Luthien's back, she felt herself getting weaker and colder, the sticky blood oozing from her wound and down her side. She held on desperately to the warmth of Luthien's fur, but her eyes drifted shut and she began to slip away. All she could feel was the undulating motion of the running wolf. Chapter 7. When Willa opened her eyes again, she was still clinging to Luthien's back. She wasn't sure where they were or how much time had passed, other than that the sun was rising in the eastern sky, and the blood was still seeping from her aching body. The wolves of the pack had come back together with her and Luthien on a rocky prominence that rose up from the surrounding terrain. All the wolves were looking in the same direction. Wincing from the pain, Willa slowly lifted her head. The wolves gazed out across a sweeping view of the mountains, the long blue ranges cascading one layer after another into the distance, the wispy white clouds hanging low in the valleys, with the dark peaks and ridges rising among them. She knew that the wolves of a pack far from their den didn't just stare off into the distance for no reason. When wolves were far from home, they acted with purpose. They ran with purpose, tracked with purpose. And now they waited with purpose. They seemed to be watching for something in particular to happen, but Willa didn't know what it was. Then she saw an old black bear trundling down the slope of the nearby hill. All the wolves in the pack turned their heads in unison and looked at the bear. This was what they had come for. But they did not move. They did not attack. They waited, and they watched. The bear moved slowly, arduously, as if every step was painful to it as it made its way down the slope into the closest valley. It seemed gout-sick or wounded in some way. Were the wolves going to attack and kill the wounded bear? She wondered, for the wolf and the bear were natural enemies. But the wolves did not move forward. They stayed perfectly silent and perfectly still, watching the bear until it disappeared into the mist of the valley. Luthien seemed to take note of exactly where the bear had gone out of sight. Then she looked at the other wolves in the pack and moved in that direction. Clearly understanding her, the other wolves slunk in close behind and followed her in single file. As Willa glanced back, she could see that the two male wolves stayed closest to Luthien, right with her, strong and steady, their bodies hunched low, their muscles tight, and their eyes alert. The two pale-gazed young pups were slinking along behind them, wary and uncertain, one of them visibly shaking, his tail between his legs. Willa did not know what kind of danger they were all going into, but she could feel her body responding to theirs, the hair on her arms rising up, her ears tingling, her temples pounding. The wolves followed the trail of the sick bear into the white wall of thick fog and down into the valley. The colors of the forest faded into gray. As the rocks and trees around them disappeared in the mist, Willa felt Luthien's muscles tensing, ready for the fight. Chapter 8. As the long, single-file line of wolves moved through the fog, Willa couldn't see anything but white ahead, on either side or behind her. She couldn't hold back the pang of fear. Where were the wolves taking her? She held onto Luthien's neck as the wolf lowered her nose to the ground and followed the large tracks of the wounded bear. Years before, when her mamma could still walk, Willa remembered crouching down in the undergrowth of the forest with her twin sister, Aliu, the two of them watching their mamma's wrinkled fingers tracing reverently over the tracks on the ground, the deer with their cloven hooves, the mountain lions and wolves with their four claws, and the massive bear tracks with five distinct claws on each foot. Where the earth was soft, the prints were easy to see. But where the bear had crossed over rocky ground, the tracks faded and then disappeared. But Luthien kept her nose to the ground and followed the bear's scent. No animal in the forest other than the bear itself had a better sense of smell than the wolf. A whirring, whistling noise passed overhead. Willa looked up, trying to figure out what it was, but the fog was too thick to see anything. She glanced behind her and saw the two young pups looking timidly up into the fog. They didn't know what it was either. When Luthien stopped, the other wolves gathered around her, the leader of the pack, and as the mist cleared, they all looked out in the same direction. Willa lifted her eyes. She gazed in awe across a flat, silver-shimmering body of water, a vast lake that extended for as far as she could see before disappearing into the mist. Water poured down from natural springs in the surrounding rocks, but the surface of the lake stayed perfectly smooth. As great flocks of mergansers, teals, and other ducks